Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Exotics Club webinar. I am delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager at the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for attending. And basically today we're going to be discussing reproductive disease in snakes and lizards. I suppose the first point that we really have to consider for these is that a lot of the reptiles that we'll see coming into private practice, these aren't animals the owners were intending to breed with. They may have been kept in isolation, sometimes since purchase. So the concept that this animal may be thinking of breeding and going through reproductive cycles can be quite a shock to these people. A lot of them, of course, have no idea of the sex of their pet either. So having an isolated snake or a lizard that maybe wants to produce eggs is something that they just hasn't come anywhere near what they're thinking about. So I guess when we're starting going down looking at these cases, we've got to think about husbandry, which we'll come back to, but also happily determining the gender of the animals presenting to you is quite important, as we obviously need to be aware whether reproductive disease is something that's going to become a factor or not long term. Lizards, most of the species you're going to be seeing will be dimorphic, and most of these you're going to have big prominent femoral pores or precloacal pores in the male. So in this picture, the male is off to the right here. And on the females, you're going to have very hard to see or much less prominent femoral pores, precloacal pores being seen as well. So very obvious to see on those, on the mature animals, those differences. Males are also much brighter, horns, crests, dewlaps, things like that that make them look more vibrant. And tail width may be a factor as well. If you look at these two bearded dragons, for example, again, you can see the male on the right-hand side has a thicker tail containing hemipenes. The female on the left here has less bulges and it's less obvious. And if we just go through and have a little look at the next female here, again, we can see the tail looks quite narrow on face value, but here are very pale and perhaps insignificant femoral pores that you can just make out, but the tail sort of tapers away to being quite narrow. And that really for the lizards is the most common thing you're going to be looking for identifying gender. For the snakes, you can look at tail length. Males have a longer tail from their cloaca downwards, much higher number of scales down here. Maybe the tail looks wider. But really for these, you're going to be probing these to do that. Now, you might not have a set of proper snake probes in the practice. That doesn't stop you from doing this. What we would use really is a Tomcat catheter would be suitable for most of these and easy and available for you. So for probing these, the males have hemipenes that lie either side of the tail base. They're inverted and there's a central lumen that runs down here. The females have just must sacs down here. So in the males with a relaxed tail, when you're passing the catheter down, it will pass up to 12 scales in length. In females, it passes only up to 6. But you need to have a relaxed tail, so get the tail nice and straight, and then you can slide this down. And what you basically do is you slide it until you get resistance. You then pull that catheter out, and then what you're doing is you're basically popping it against the vent, looking at how far it's gone down, and you're counting the number of scales. You've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So this one is reading the book, and this is very clearly a male that we've got here in this circumstance. And I think to be fair, when we're looking at what reproductive disease we're going to see in the lizards and snakes, you really get three things. You're going to get cloacal organ prolapse in the males if they're oversexed or done trauma or things going on there. Then in the females, you're either going to get follicles forming on the ovaries and getting stasis here or problems associated with that stage of gravidity, or you're going to have issues with egg binding once they've ovulated these follicles at the other side of that. The live bearers, really, we're not going to be discussing today because you very rarely see an issue with the live bearing snakes and lizards. It's always the egg layers that we have a problem with. And obviously, when we're thinking about why are we seeing so much reproductive disease in the captive reptiles, it all goes straight back to husbandry again. And a lot of these, it's the nutritional compromise of the females, if we're going to focus on the females first, that we see. So going back to thinking about vitamin D, calcium supplementation and things like that, it's all very, very important. So reviewing that husbandry, what UV lights have you got, what supplementation they're giving is very, very important as you're going through looking at this. And because these people aren't expecting their female rabbits to breed, their female reptiles to breed, they're not preparing them adequately for this. And so this whole thing comes as a shock to them, and the animal's poorly prepared. So with the reptiles, they go through normal cycles of follicular development followed by regression. That happens as standard. It's dependent on their size. So when they're big enough to breed, they will try and breed. It's not dependent on age. So in captivity, they can age quite soon, as it were, much sooner than you perhaps would think for wanting to breed. Females can produce eggs without a male. They do not need to be mated. They do not need a male to be present to make them ovulate. Temperature, light intensity, photoperiod, nutrition are all relevant to this. Obviously, hormone cycles normally follow through as well with these. And there's lots of fat storage and fat moving around to incorporate this into the follicles, aside the sort of issues with calcium as well that we may see. And a lot of these egg-laying species, particularly the lizards, will produce large numbers of eggs or offspring at any one particular time. And I guess this is in contrast to the birds, for example, where the birds are producing eggs sequentially. The reptiles will do it all at once. And so when they're getting full of eggs or follicles, they will go off food. And so then they are completely dependent on the stores that they have available to, when they're ovulating these eggs, when they're calcifying all of these shells in one go, they've got to have, they need all this stuff all at that time, just when they're gone anorexic. So when you're looking at the husbandry and care of captive reptiles, a male is not trying to produce a nest of eggs or suddenly calcify them all in one day at the same time. Juveniles, much as we see lots of metabolic bone disease and problems with those, this is slow and progressive over time as they are growing. They normally can cope. Maybe they end up a bit bendy, but they normally are coping with that system. But the females, because they basically are producing such a large quantity of eggs all at one go, they're filling the coelomic cavity. They become anorexic, they can go into some sort of metabolic crisis, whether it be liver, calcium, or other things involved, which can upset them. So you might have a female going through a normal reproductive process, but because it's captive, we just completely let them down. And obviously, this is normally a summer thing more than a winter thing that we're seeing. And just to sort of make the point, this is just showing you a veiled chameleon female here that has got follicular stasis. And what you can see here is just the sheer volume of follicles this female has. She's very distended. Obviously, there are some issues maybe with skeletal density on this animal as well, which you can see in passing here. But the point of this is there is no room for lungs, air sacs, food. There is no room left apart from follicle development. So this poor female is unable to compensate to some extent. She's completely relying on her reserves. And it's very obvious from this radiograph that this female, or this radiograph, second radiograph, she has no skeletal density at all. This is, I guess, reproduction-induced metabolic bone disease, if you want to think of something different. But, the sudden need that she's got for all this has just depleted any chance she's got of successfully taking this reproductive cycle through to completeness. And it's important to realise that a lot of people assume, because they look fat and distended, that, oh, they're in good body condition, they're great, that they seem to be doing fine. When you start looking at some of these, what you want to be looking for is if there's any evidence of body condition loss. So they might be weighing quite nice, but, you know, you're looking over pelvis, and this is obviously not a breeding female, but just to make the point, if you can see the amount of body condition loss we've got here, this is what you're looking for on these females to see how well they're coping with repetitive breeding, if you like. And this actually is a case that was presented collapsed. The owner thought the animal was fat and was doing fine because it had a big belly, but here you can see that repetitive reproductive attempts has seriously taken its toll on this female. So we've got to sort of, I guess, look after these as best we can do. Now, when we're looking at trying to get a diagnosis for these, what we want to try and get a clear distinction here is, are you follicles, are you eggs? And that's quite an important thing in terms of how we're going to manage these. So for follicles, really, we've got to confirm there are large numbers of vitellogenic mature follicles present in this animal. And they might have been here for some time, they may have developed more recently, and depending on clinical presentation, this may be a reptile that is coping with its pregnancy at this stage, or it may be a reptile that is going into metabolic crisis, and we need to work out how sick this lizard is with these follicles. If you're looking for eggs, again, this little mossy gecko here, another female reptile with severe metabolic bone disease, no calcium in the calcium sacs at all. But again, we've very clearly on this particular image here, we've got two shelled, egg-shaped eggs, which you'd expect in a gecko. You know, we know this female has got eggs in here. These aren't follicles that are developing. And it's important to distinguish between these two. So there's a few steps you can take in doing that. One of the steps you could look at would be to look at a blood profile, showing you a jugular here and a bearded just for being a bit different from a tail vein. But obviously, you know, these females could be having problems with secondary sepsis. They could have problems with just going into metabolic crisis. Fat metabolism could be upset, hepatic lipidosis kicking in. Maybe they've got dehydrated, some secondary renal disease, or we're looking at calcium as well. So, you know, really there's a whole range of things you might want to be doing for these. I certainly would look at ionized calcium if you thought that was relevant in these. Your total calcium and proteins will be elevated. And it is worth looking at, like I say, hematology, bile acids, uric acid as well, if you get given the option to do that. Now, if your lizard is otherwise appearing well, then you might go, well, okay, you know, it's running around, it's still quite active, it looks quite bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Maybe I don't need to be worrying overly about it being in metabolic crisis. Radiography is probably your next fairly essential step, because we're looking here, depending on the species, either a horizontal beam lateral or a DV, but I'm looking for, do you have a soft tissue density within your coelomic cavity? And is this round-like follicles, or does it look like eggs with shells? And that's really the first instance that you're looking for. Radiography is relatively easy to do that. If you are having lots of chameleons through, very simple to do, just give them a branch to sit on. They'll be much happier with that, and take your horizontal beam with them sitting on a branch, and you can get quite a nice view. But again, this is another female here. She's blowing herself out now, making herself look big and grumpy. But again, we very clearly on here have got a complete set of follicles filling up the coelomic cavity here, and this sort of is the chest here at that point. But this basically is giving us the diagnosis that we need to know that she's in follicular sort of stasis. Ultrasound is very good for these. If you have access to an ultrasound machine and you're good at scanning, even if you're not good at scanning, you know, if you're scanning through the coelomic cavity of these, follicles are overtly obvious as small, particularly the vitellogenic follicles, they will be round, soft tissue densities within the abdomen, and there'll be loads of them. If you're looking for eggs, you can see then you'll get the acoustic shadowing around the eggshells, but again, you can also pick up on those as well. And most of these lizards, with a careful clinical examination, and I do mean careful, you can manipulate and feel eggs and follicles on clinical assessment, so you know these females are going through a reproductive cycle. Other options that you have if you wanted to, but probably unnecessary, but you can go in and consider doing celioscopy on these. And the important thing, I guess, to realise when you're looking at these is when you're going in, this is fat pad here, but this is quite an active follicle on an ovary here that's being developed in this lizard as well. So you can do that, but unnecessary. Generally, if you are forced into it, an X-ray will give you a guide as to whether you've got follicles or eggs, and that really is your first port of call for these that you need to do. Now, if you've got a lizard that looks okay, you've got a lizard that you think has eggs present and the eggs look reasonable, and there's no severe metabolic bone disease, no obstruction with a bladder stone or faecaliths or whatever you've got, then you could say, okay, let's see if I can persuade this animal to lay eggs. That's a possibility. And what I would do then really, you might want to preload them with calcium. A lot of people do, even in the absence of a blood test. I guess for calcium to be a factor, what you really need is low ionized calcium here. Because if you've got a low ionized calcium, you may not get proper contractility in their ability to expel the eggs properly from that. Oxytocin does work okay with the right case. You get less success in the lizards and snakes than you do with the tortoises. But certainly, if you wish to, it's worth a try. And maybe some analgesia is relevant here as well for these on those cases. And certainly, you can just go straight for it. Let's see if we can induce them. A lot of people at this stage would offer the reptile a nesting site. And I don't think that is so necessary. I think it makes us feel better because we're trying to give them somewhere to lay their eggs naturally. But with the best in the world, if you're going to go through an induction process, it's not natural. You're going to be squeezing the eggs out and you have no real choice in the matter. So to some extent, a nesting area or not, you're forcing the issue here with the egg laying, and the presence or absence of a soil or a digging substrate isn't really going to influence your success or failure with medical induction. If this animal is otherwise okay and the owner is quite keen to go home and try at home and you don't feel you need to induce yet, then great. Of course, what you could do is go for sending them home with an upgrade in the nesting environment to see if that would stimulate them to lay their eggs more naturally. But most females have sort of, they'd like to have a plan of how they're doing this and have prepared and thought about it and had test nesting sites dug and messed around for a bit. And to suddenly have a nesting site forced upon you at the last minute, some females, again, will be reluctant to go through that process. Now, if you're thinking you've got an animal that maybe it's in follicular stasis or metabolic crisis, or you're considering going forward maybe with some surgical intervention, then we've got to get some supportive care through here. We've got to stabilize this patient to maximize our chance of getting it through this metabolic crisis for them. And so first thing you want to do is let's warm them up. If they're coming in, they're hypothermic, they're collapsed, you've got to heat them up. If they can't move, that's an even temperature. If it's going to be an animal that's mobile, then just make sure it has a proper basking light and you're holding the temperature overnight in the setup, such that it's not going to chill down. Very important. These animals will be obviously maybe fluid and electrolyte deficient, so fluid therapy is needed. And if we're talking the lizards, one of your easiest way for this really is to get an IO needle placed into the tibia. Fairly standard tight site, you're just coming down through the tibial crest. I would normally put some lidocaine and bupivacaine under the site of this, sort of give it a scrub, just to sort of block out down to the periosteum on these. And then I'm using a 24 gauge, inch and a half needle to slide down, stabilizing that with a 1 mL syringe, or part of the 1 mL syringe if you like, to hold it if it's a bit longer than you thought for the animal's leg. But this is a route to get your IV fluid in. And you can either bolus that if you wish to, or otherwise you can put them onto an IO infusion and run it from an infusion pump like we're doing with this green iguana here. Second thing you're going to want to do for these really is get some nutritional support on board. If these have been anorexic for some time, they may be going into a metabolic crisis. You need to get some calories in. You probably need to get some electrolytes in. And certainly while you're doing this, most people will then reach for an oral vitamin D calcium supplement as they're going, and maybe again give it some calcium supplementation as you're here just because you feel you need to. Maybe in combination with parenteral calcium or intraosseous calcium therapy, depending on the nature of the animal. Please run some glucose through the IO needle if you wanted to as well, to sort of try and support them. So it's getting some calories in, getting electrolytes in, getting calcium in, getting glucose in as well if for these guys. And what you're trying to do is get these collapsed females in the best state possible for them. Now the next thing you've got, and it does depend on the age and the longevity of the species you're dealing with, but basically if you've got an owner that doesn't want to breed with their female lizard, then once it's sexually mature, and that might be 8 months of age, that might be a year, that might be 2 years or older, you've got a routine prophylactic spay as an option on your list. And certainly a lot of people wouldn't necessarily present them prophylactically, but if you've got a lizard coming in, it's got a belly full of follicles, it's just gone off food, the owner was sufficiently worried to present it, at that point you could say, okay, we could just spay this animal and solve the problem now before it goes into metabolic crisis. If the owner decides they don't want to go down that route at that stage, then obviously getting your supportive care measures in place, sending it home with some oral vitamin D and calcium wouldn't be a bad move. But then what you've got to do is voice the owners on how the clinical presentation might progress and try and persuade them to come in as early as possible to go for that neutering before it goes into crisis. And unfortunately, in a lot of these cases where I've had this discussion with owners and you're trying to encourage them to go for it, say, okay, we'll go home, have a think about it, come back and we'll do it as soon as we can, a very, very high percentage come back and they've waited too long. And now you have an animal in metabolic crisis that's difficult to get back for them. A healthy female lizard going through a reproductive cycle that is otherwise clinically well, they do brilliantly with routine neutering. A female lizard that has gone through the entire process of being in metabolic crisis, they are much harder, and a percentage do not make it through the process. You get them to the surgery okay, but some just fail to get going afterwards. And you may be putting in feeding tubes and things as well, but if they've got so bad, a lot of these, they are just too bad, unfortunately. Surgical treatment. We're just going to take you through a few pictures here. We've got a combination of a Rankin's dragon here, a lovely little female here, and a beardy on the pictures, but I'm just going to take you through. And you're either masking these down, inducing in a tail vein with propofol or alfaxan, whatever you want to do. Get your tube in place for these little guys. Ideally with a tongue depressor to stop them damaging the tube at the process of intubation. Get that place, and then obviously we're putting them onto a mechanical ventilator to make sure they are happily anaesthetized to go through ready for surgery. And depending on the nature of the animal, you might want to have that on IO needle in during that process, even if you perceive it to be healthy. It may be you've decided that that is a sensible thing to have in place, just as an insurance policy and run some fluids through. That wouldn't be a bad problem. And when you're going for these, you're going in just off the midline for most of these species, going in, seeing what's in there. A lot of them will have, obviously, follicular activity, which you're then removing. And you do really need to have ligating clips for these. It's very difficult to hand tie. And these are very, very susceptible to rupture and damage. And certainly some of the heavily gravid females, if they, for example, fell off a branch or something, they can pop the blood supply to an ovary and they can bleed out into an ovary and present as a sudden death case with these as well. So just bear in mind that these are fragile things that need to be manipulated very carefully surgically, not to cause hemorrhage, as we've got a little bit in this picture, but also to avoid causing an egg yolk coelomitis or something from damage and rupture. And then obviously you're closing them up afterwards. We've got this little Rankin here on a Doppler here to make sure that the heart rate's going okay, still being ventilated at this stage, although we have dramatically reduced down her frequency of ventilation during the recovery phase. So she's actually down here to having one breath every 20 seconds on the ventilator here, just so we're trying to sort of get her to do it herself. Closing of these, you do want to close the muscle layer as one layer underneath, and then you're looking at putting horizontal mattress sutures in the skin for these guys. And this is opsite spray being used just to seal that end over there. Some people would use glue and things as well, whichever you want to. And then you basically recover them, nice even temperature, wait for them to sort of spontaneously breathe before you extubate. But it's important to know these do feel pain as well, and to make sure that you are giving them appropriate analgesia for these cases. And obviously, they can recover very nicely. This is a bearded dragon post spay here who's come round and obviously much happier for having things removed. Normally for these, I guess I would be keeping them in overnight and sending them home the following day, all things being even for a routine spay for the lizards. A few things to, I suppose, just point at you, some differentials here or other problems of reproductive disease that we might see. We've mentioned, obviously, ovastasis, which is what we have here. And you can see very clearly we've got round shapes here with no shells filling the coelomic cavity in this bearded dragon. And you can see how easy it would be for these to be damaged and rupture or bleed internally. Egg stasis, this is now a water dragon here, but again, more oval shaped. Hopefully some definition of eggshell here. And again, this is oviducts now full of eggs coming out. You need to take, if you're going to do this, you need to make sure that the ovaries come out with this as well, or they will ovulate into their body cavity. If you are just going in and taking out ovaries, because these ovaries are so closely associated with the vena cava, there is the risk that you may leave some microscopic bits of an ovary left behind that you can't see clinically that would regrow into another ovary the next season. And so for me, if the oviducts in these females haven't been used or they look healthy, I leave them behind on the grounds that then if we do by accident get another ovarian regrowth and this female decides to ovulate, she has the capacity to go forward and lay the eggs as opposed to being stuck in the situation that she's going to be ovulating into a body cavity. So, and it also, of course, reduces morbidity and length of procedure as well. It gets them out and recovers them quicker. So I remove oviducts if I have to. If I don't need to, if they haven't been used, I leave them behind, and I'm basically doing an ovariectomy, really, for these females. And you will see in some of these, you can see some horrible things going on in here. I mean, in this one here, we've got female lizard veiled here now. We've gone from midline, which is one of the approaches here. But, I mean, the ovaries are just disgusting granulomatous mess here that was going to set up adhesions and all sorts of things going on as a consequence of that. Here we've got microsporidium, which we do see. It's a beardy thing. This is a post-mortem, obviously. But what we've got here is two ovaries with granulomas full of microsporidium here. Normal oviduct, colon, obviously renal tissue is sitting here, look, and here, liver here. But again, you know, chronic granulomatous ovaries, another reason for saying goodbye, really. You will see cystic follicles, which we've got here. We're using radiosurgery in this case to remove these from a water dragon. Here we've got an ovarian abscess that was filling the entire coelomic cavity. Obviously, that needed to come out, and she's having an ovariectomy here. This female went on to do fine. Egg yolk coelomitis, we've got some egg yolk coming from ovaries around here in body cavity. Fairly mild, this one, but you would go in and take out the follicles. You'd take out the eggs, and you'd swirl through the coelomic cavity and remove as much of the egg yolk as you could do during that process. And just one more here, a very old picture here, but just making a point for you here. This is an oviductal rupture. This is an animal that was treated by me with oxytocin to induce some egg laying in a female beardy. We were unsuccessful. She didn't lay. She needed to go for surgery, obviously, because she didn't lay. And in the process, we found that she had ruptured her oviduct as a consequence of trying to lay these eggs alongside the therapy she'd been given. So although you're going to try and do some induction on these, maybe, or give them a nesting site, if these guys with eggs do not lay the eggs, They then become a surgical case, and you go in and you spay them, and you take out oviducts, and you take out ovaries as well. And the ovaries in these will be small because they've ovulated with tiny little ovaries versus a big ovary that you're going to get with animals going through follicular development. So a lot of these do end up surgical, and a lot of owners don't really expect to have to spend that money on a spay or something, but it's something that should always be on your mind with the female reptiles. As soon as you have any suspicion of reproductive disease, go for a spay if you can persuade them to do that. The sooner you do it, the better that animal will be in the longer term. For the male lizards, really there's two things for the lizards we need to be aware of. First one here is a hemipenal prolapse, which you can see the hemipenis can be prolapsed from either side, really, sort of coming forwards, if you like, out from the tail base. One of these can be amputated. We just put circumferential ligature around it, or maybe a mattress suture through it, and basically amputate this out of the way. Very similar to the sort of technique you'd use in tortoises, I guess. But quite commonly seen, and these can be removed quite happily with that. Second thing, I guess, that we're being asked to do more and more of these days, really, is castration. Now, classically, the whole castration thing used to be brought about due to iguanas, because male iguanas are mean and unpleasant, and there's loads of sort of techniques for how people might try and persuade these guys to settle down. They might paint their parietal eye, reduce day length, reduce UV light, keep them colder, give them something to distract it, like a fluffy toy or a handling glove or something. A whole variety of ways that people might have been trying to stop their male iguanas from being mean to them. And obviously, a lot of these were either questionable, short-lived, and castration was sort of on the terms of, well, why don't we castrate them? And really, if you're going to have castration to work to limit aggression, you've got to get in there before they become sexually mature, which means your male iguana doesn't look like a male iguana anymore. It just looks like a juvenile. And there have been some attempts at drug therapy as well, which we're not really going to be going through today, but that things like the desloral implants have been considered as an option for some of these for temporary control. But really, the case in point is moving more on to reproductive control in the beardies. And for these, you very rarely see the aggressive bearded dragons. That's the first point, although they have been reported. But what you will get, particularly if people are keeping a pair of these or a little harem together, is the boys are persistently annoying of the females. They will chase them around and bite them, stimulate them into reproductive activity. And if you're going to keep a social group of beardies together, what you need is the group to be non-reproductive. And so castrating the male is part of that to try and reduce the amount of harassment that they're going to give to the females and the amount they're going to be stimulating the females to breed. So castration is something that is becoming more common as a method of keeping groups of bearded dragons together, I guess. Paramedian incision on the ventral midline again, and your testes are fairly obvious, attached to vena cava. You've basically got to bring them out the body cavity gently with some cotton buds or Q-tips. You're going to be using ligating clips again for these to get the testes out. This is a mature male green iguana here, just to make the point, because the anatomy is just so much easier to see here, which obviously is quite nice. And what we've got basically is testes here. You've got a very nice adrenal gland here, followed by the main vessel here on this particular side. So your hemoclips are going to have to run across between these two to preserve the adrenal gland. And it's much easier to visualize the adrenals in the green iguanas because of the non-pigmentation in the beardies, because you have a lot of coelomic pigmentation. And sometimes it can be a little bit more difficult to distinguish between that. And this is basically from a male bearded dragon, but you can see here you've got some melanin deposition in the testes as well already, and so it can be a little more difficult to distinguish things relative to some of the other species. Once these are out, same deal, you're going through closing muscle layer, and then you're doing horizontal mattress in the skin, because obviously the skin can be inverting. And like I said, we've Opsite sprayed, and here we're actually going to use tissue glue on this time. just as an alternative to seal this wound. And don't forget things like local is also on your list as well. You could local infiltrate some of these wounds to keep them happy post surgery to make sure they are okay. The other important thing to realize with males too is they can be unpleasant. They can be unpleasant to each other. So you need to make sure you've got the gender of these right. And so we do get involved in doing some hemipenile surgery. And this is just an example here where you've got an abscessated bite wound into a hemipenis here, where you've got massive infection flowing around, lots of pus. And in some of these, you may have to go in and open the tail at this point and remove the hemipenis and its retractor muscle to get rid of it. And sometimes you do that on both sides as well. And while we're thinking about tail amputations and things with these guys, you do have to be careful that if you do interfere with the retractor muscle of the hemipenis, which you would do if you were going to do a relatively high amputation on these species, so amputating to sort of this sort of level will potentially interfere with the retractor muscle, which runs from that inverted hemipenis back here. If you damage that, both your hemipenes will just prolapse because they've got no restraint mechanism anymore. So in those circumstances, if you are going to be doing an amputate on a tail that high up, you need to either anchor those retractor muscles round over your stump of your tail, or you're going in and you're removing the retractor muscles and the hemipenes to stop them having hemipenile prolapses post-surgery. Also something you would see, of course, if they've got spinal injuries and things like that, just to throw that over to the side for you as well. Now, I guess we need to think about snakes as well here, aside the lizards. And if we're looking at female snakes now, in the females, the ovaries span over the caudal third of the snake. It is difficult to perform an ovariectomy in the snake nicely. It's just the incision you need is just too difficult. Follicular stasis in the snakes is less of an issue. It's more egg stasis that we're seeing in these. And to be honest, the snakes are quite easy because you can count them. If they're full of eggs, if they're full of follicles, you can see a mid-body, you can see its body swelling. If they ovulate, you can see them ovulate. And obviously, you can count how many eggs they have produced in their oviducts. And so you can, with a lot of these, consider induction, physical manipulation, much easier in the snakes than you can do in the lizards. So maybe our approach is a little bit different for these. And if you want to diagnose these, you're scanning, you're x-raying, but in many cases, what you're doing is you're just counting the number of eggshells clearly on an x-ray. You're okay, there's five eggs that have got to come out, so you know how many you're looking for. And a lot of people will go down the route of physical manipulation for these, and there's a few different techniques here. And some will try this conscious. They will put some KY jelly into the cloaca, and they will start trying to milk these eggs out of their snakes at home without bringing them in to see you, and you've no idea what sort of level of damage or whatever else they're doing internally, which is concerned. So milking these is something that I would not be such a fan of. Second things you could do for these is you can do decompression per cloaca, which I'd argue is quite nice. If you've got them close to the cloaca and you can get in there and you can decompress this egg and flatten it, and the snake can pass it itself, or you can drag it out with a pair of forceps or something, that's quite nice if you can do that. I will show you some pictures of percutaneous aspiration later as well, actually, which again, I don't do, but occasionally you're forced into it. And again, if you do do a percutaneous aspiration and you're hoping that you're not going to get a sthenomyelitis and the egg is going to collapse and the snake will pass it itself because you're trying to avoid going through surgery, then okay, maybe, but I certainly wouldn't be advocating that really as a unless you really had to. But if we have a little look at a king snake, I'm just going to show you the surgical approach for these. Again, this female very clearly has one egg sitting distal cloaca. I would argue this isn't a surgical case, but it did go for surgery, and it's going to serve the purpose, I guess, to show you that technique as we go through it. So for these, it's obviously very obvious where your egg is. And you basically, anaesthetizing your snake, we tend to, with a lot of these, we would either use proper 4-hour Fax and IV, or in a small snake like this, we'd probably anaesthetize them in a Ziploc bag, wait for them to lose their writing reflex, pop a tube down them, mechanically ventilate, and we're good to go. Again, this is quite older pictures here to show you on this case. But basically, you're going through body wall, just distal to ribs, through the coelomic membrane, and the oviduct with the eggs is pretty much right there in your face. You can then do your C-section, as it were, of the oviduct to get the egg out. You can use a spoon or something to gently elevate it. And having done that and got the egg out, you're then going to sew in a simple, continuous fashion the oviduct. And then you can do the same with a muscle layer followed by horizontal mattress in the skin for these two to get rid of the eggs. And normally, if you've got one egg present, that's fine. If you've got more than one egg, you would try and milk the other eggs down into that surgical incision, so you're creating just the one entrance port into the oviduct or oviducts, because bear in mind they could have eggs in two oviducts ongoing at the same time. So that's okay, that's one option. This is percutaneous aspiration. We've scrubbed this snake. This is a corn snake now. And obviously, we're getting the egg contents out, hoping to decompress it, and then we're going to let these eggs pass down and out of this snake if we can in an ideal world. But I guess for me, my preferred option for the snakes now is none of the above. I go in with the endoscope. They're long and thin. Their eggs are one after the other in the oviducts. So for these, I go in and anaesthetize them. Wait until they've lost their writing reflex and we can go in and have a look. Again, intubation, just here another picture for showing you for these. But now what I'm doing is I'm going in with the endoscope, aiming, and this is done under saline insufflation at this point, going in to spot the end of the oviduct and get the egg down there that I can see it. And what you're able to do with these, if you're going in with saline, is you're using the saline to insufflate the cloaca, but also you can use it to insufflate the oviduct. So when you're going in, you're using the saline to lift the oviduct from around this egg. You can just about squeeze your scope past it if you like, or get somewhere close to it. But what you're doing is you're checking that there is no oviductal infection, or it's not a slug where you've just got retained egg yolk with no shell, or you're looking to say, is this a viable looking egg? Yes, I can see that. Is the oviduct now clear away from it? Yes, I can. Is there any oviductal infection? No, there isn't. You then take your scope out. I would then milk that egg out. Now you know that it is safe to milk that egg out because you're able to know the oviduct's nice and clear, know it's not got any adhesions or anything else going on. Progressively milk this out, use some cotton buds, slow and gentle basically, to get the snake to pass this egg out per cloaca. And once you've done this, if there's another egg, then you just go in and you go and have a look at the second egg now. And while you're there, you can evaluate any nature of trauma or bruising that you did to the oviduct. Go in, cut to second egg, same again with your scope, insufflate around it, and then obviously you can milk that egg out again if you're happy with that. Go in and repeat the process for as many eggs as you like. Okay, you are limited how cranial you can get if you've got a sort of an 18-inch endoscope, but if you're talking 3 or 4 eggs, which in most cases you will be worst case, at the back end, you can do that. Conversely, what you could do for these if you're worried is you could go with a medical induction on these, and providing you're getting sort of an egg out on a daily basis, that's probably okay, and you could wait for more eggs to come down. You could do a little bit of massage and physical manipulation, but let the snake do it itself. But I think for me, given the choice, if they're being presented, I will be anaesthetizing, using the endoscope to enable me to physically manipulate these safely. And then probably after that, I'll be giving some oxytocin and some treatment once I got the eggs out. Obviously, sterile saline being used. I tend to use a giving set from a bag and just run it in through the surgical sheath. You find with the examination sheath, the flow of the Ceylon isn't quite enough on the scope to do what you need to do. So I will put your surgical sheath on because you'll get a better flow rate of fluid through there to enable this to be a successful technique for you. We do see follicular stasis in some of these, and they will go into metabolic stasis and collapse and get ascites and things. And this is just a Burmese here. But just so you're aware, but that's less commonly. And in the male snakes, if they're getting a hemipenile prolapse, it is identical to what you're doing. This is one that's been out for some time here and obviously quite damaged. But you would do an identical process on these relative to what you would be doing with the lizards. That is the end of our webinar, and we do have a couple of questions that have come in. First one is analgesia for these undergoing surgical procedures. What would we do? Certainly for these, you're looking at an injectable non-steroidal such as meloxicam, I think, as a starting point. More and more for these reptiles now, I'm considering premedicant as well. I'm not just straight going for Alfaxolone alone. And a lot of these I'm pre-medicating with a low dose of ketamine, maybe 5 to 10 mg per kg, and probably morphine more than likely as my pre-med choice for them over things like buprenorphine or butorphanol. But certainly there'll be an opioid there as well. And the local blockade at your muscle and skin layer does make a big difference to these two. So I will be using some lidocaine because it's quick acting. Well, it doesn't last for very long. I combine that with some bupivacaine, which lasts for longer, and obviously it takes a bit more to kick in. But certainly that sort of blockade works very nicely for them as well. The other question that's been asked too is what about antibiotics? And it's difficult, I guess, to be sterile with a lot of these conditions that we've got here, where you've got an egg yolk sedimitis, or you've got a granuloma, or you're doing a hemipenile prolapse, or whatever you're doing, you've got to anticipate you may get some contamination of your surgical site. So for these, I guess my standard is for aerobic and anaerobic cover, and that ceftazidime would be the first choice for that. Ceftazidime you give at 20 mg per kg every 3 days. So for a routine spay where you felt you had minimal contamination, or it was say a caesarean where you in a snake where you'd left the oviducts in, but your fetal contamination was well under control, I might just do a one-off injection at the time of surgery. If you wanted to, you could always do a second injection at the point of discharge, which would at least be 48 hours or something, and maybe a bit longer after that. So you're getting two lots in. Your immediate post-op check could be planned to be 3 days later. So that's your third dose. And probably then for most of these, that should be more than enough depending on the case that you're seeing. If you genuinely felt there was significant contamination and you wanted to extend it for longer than that and the owners weren't prepared to come back for repeat ceftazidime injections, then you could, for your sins, you could go for enrofloxacin orally or metronidazole orally in combination for 3 or 4 weeks after that. But in most of these cases, because you're going through surgery, it's a injection at the time of surgery, injection at discharge, injection at post-op check. That's given you 10 days antibiotic cover. In most of these cases, that is adequate for what you need. I'm now going to pass back to Emma. That is the end of the presentation. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.